Sometimes it's hard to imagine, but these statistics are real. According to estimates from Feeding America, more than 490,000 Connecticut residents struggle with hunger. More than 131,000 children are considered food insecure. And so there is one answer, at least one of the many answers, that Connecticut is trying to address this problem. It's called food pharmacy, and Danbury will soon be welcoming food pharmacy designed to fight food insecurity in the area. And joining us to tell us all about this is Isabel Almeida, who is the president of United Way of Western Connecticut, as well as Dr. Brenda Ares, who is from New Vance Health. And thank you both for being here. I appreciate it. How are you?
Doing well.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Yes, of course. First of all, Brenda, can you tell me how to pronounce your last name? I know I botched it. I could feel it in my soul. I could feel it.
It's okay. It's Ayers.
Ayers. Okay. Thank you so much. So first of all, Isabel, tell us why we are seeing this opening in the Danbury, the greater Danbury area, specifically for Connecticut.
So we had the opportunity to apply for a congressionally directed spending earmark grant through our Senate offices, Senators Murphy and Blumenthal. And we worked in partnership with our colleagues at New Vance Health to really look at the critical need of the linkage between food insecurity and health disparities in our community. And so this is a model that New Vance Health is pioneering over the border in New York in their Vassar Hospital location. And so we felt this was a really good opportunity to leverage some of the learnings that they have and bring a critically important program to the Danbury community.
Dr. Ayers, tell us about that.
And so we're grateful to have received this grant to support that.
That's fantastic. Could you tell us about that program, Dr. Ayers? I know New Vance Health oversees here in Connecticut, Norwalk, as well as Danbury Hospital. So understand the link there. But tell us about the program that Isabel was just talking about and why New Vance is so focused on this for the community.
Oh, absolutely. And again, thank you for this opportunity to share this this great initiative that we're doing here at New Vance. I can tell you that New Vance Health, under the leadership of Dr. John Murphy, who is our CEO, is extremely committed to improving the health of the communities that we serve and understanding how prevalent food insecurity is and how impactful it is on the outcomes that we are trying to affect. Using food as medicine, nutrition as medicine makes logical sense. We had an opportunity in Poughkeepsie to partner with Dutchess Outreach, which is a community-based organization that has long been leading the way in Poughkeepsie and in the greater Dutchess County area in providing food resource programs for people who are in need. In addition, they provide clothing, they help with medication assistance, so they are very much invested in the community in Poughkeepsie. So New Vance had an opportunity a little over a year ago to partner with them and bring a food as medicine program to our patients here at New Vance. Dutchess Outreach has a food pantry already in place. What we are bringing is the addition of a registered dietitian nutritionist to do education and nutrition support. And we are also partnering with the Culinary Institute of America, which is right down the road from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, to bring in culinary students to offer cooking demonstrations and education, as well as create a food as medicine recipe book for the participants. And we will be screening our patients for food insecurity in our primary care office and those who qualify and also have a nutrition-sensitive diagnosis such as hypertension, but certainly other things like diabetes or congestive heart failure are also nutrition-sensitive. These patients will get a referral to the Food as Medicine program where they will be able to shop at no cost at the grocery store style pantry that is currently at Dutchess Outreach. So we'll be tracking, you know, their outcomes around hypertension and diabetes control, as well as offering the education and nutritional support. Hopefully, the goal here, in addition to affecting the outcomes, is to also change behavior and increase access and decrease food insecurity at the same time.
Wow, that was so much great information. I love, first of all, using food as medicine. Such a fantastic concept. Love the idea of cooking demonstrations. Love even making some kind of a recipe book. Food is medicine. Like, I love all of these concepts. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, ladies, but I've not heard of a model of like this anywhere else in Connecticut. Am I right in saying that?
I believe there are two... Oh, go ahead, Dr. Ayers.
No. Go ahead, Isabel.
So I believe there are two other programs in existence, one in Hartford and one in the Valley, Derby, Shelton area. So we are kind of standing on the shoulders of others who are beginning to pioneer this work. But you're right, this is relatively new. And again, I'll turn it to Dr. Ayers, as she's done some extensive research across the country to seek out best practices to help inform the launch of this program.
And so, again, we're talking to Isabel Almeida, who is the president of United Way of Western Connecticut, as well as Dr. Brenda Ayers of New Vance Health, talking about food pharmacy. And it's expected to open in the fall. What I thought was really interesting as I was reading this article about this, I was reading that this is a really great spot for it to be opening because it says the center is serving a large segment of Danbury's population. According to Feeding America, more than 10% of the population in Congressional District 5, which includes Danbury, is considered food insecure. So that can't be a coincidence that that's where this is all going to be happening.
No, it's not. And absolutely correct. And, you know, we have to meet people where they are and where the need is the greatest. And it's also not a coincidence that where you have communities that have larger minority population, that food insecurity is also higher and highest in these communities. So it was a strategic choice. And the fact that we're partnering with the Connecticut Institute for Communities is also by design. They do fantastic work and already have a lot of community-based programs and resources in place. And again, this is about creating a synergy between the community-based organizations and the healthcare system to really create programs that anchor into the community and serve the population as best as we can.
And Isabel, if people want to learn more information about food pharmacy ahead of its opening, where can they go?
They can certainly go to our website at uwwesternct.org to learn more about the food pharmacy.
It's so exciting. And I thank you both for coming on to explain this model and how we're going to continue to combat the issue of food insecurity here in Connecticut. And thank you for being such a big part of that.
Thank you so much for having us and for caring about this issue.
Absolutely. And again, we had the opportunity of speaking with Isabel Almeida, who is the president of United Way of Western Connecticut, as well as Dr. Brenda Ayers of New Vance Health, talking about food pharmacy coming to the greater Danbury area as early as the fall. So we're excited about that.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Julius, I think this is such an important topic. We are in May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we are tackling depression. The one thing I think that comes to mind with this, Julius, is that it's a term that gets tossed around a lot. I am depressed, or I feel like depression is in my family. How do you know, though, Julius, that you're not just in a season of life versus you actually have chronic depression or you have, like, undiagnosed depression? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's a great question. You know, how do I know if I'm really wrestling with depression is really the issue. And that's a difficult one because there, you know, like with any mental illness, you could be mildly, moderately, or severely. And so there's a spectrum, and you could be mildly depressed or you could be severely depressed. But how do you know if you have, you know, the National Institute of Mental Health has some guidelines. And what they say is that, you know, if you're constantly feeling fatigue or decreased energy, or if you're feeling hopeless or worthless constantly, or if you have difficulty concentrating or have difficulty sleeping or irritability, if you're restless or if you're irritable constantly, or if you lack of interest in things that you once found helpful. And I always say, you know, I'm looking for patterns as a counselor. I always look for patterns of thought in a person's life. And if it's nearly every day, you know, for at least 2 weeks, you know, you might want to talk to somebody, and there could be either a chemical imbalance, or sometimes there could be an emotional trauma in your life that you're not even really aware of.
Mm.
And so, yeah, it's there's no single cause for depression. But the key that I want to, you know, bring to your listeners is talk about it. Don't be afraid to get help, because we just want to cover that. And, oh, I'm not depressed. And sometimes people, when they are depressed, it's amazing how after going through treatment, you know, after 3 or 4 weeks, it could be that they'll feel a lot better and they won't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow, I didn't realize I was back there.
Yeah.
But you gotta push yourself to talk about it.
Well, the thing is, I would think that this would be more common to talk about. When you look at statistics, so I'm looking right now at the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance statistics nationally. Yeah. And what's alarming is these date back to 2018. So this doesn't even account for the years of the pandemic. But when you look at 2018, it says major depressive disorder affects more than 17 million American adults. 1.9 million children ages 3 to 17 have been diagnosed. And what I think is interesting here is that it's more prevalent in women than in men. Why do you think that is, Julius?
Well, I think women tend to have a higher, well, and I don't want to say overall, but women can be very hard on themselves in terms of wanting their view of life.
Mm.
You know, with some women, I think the way that they view life is that, hey, we've got a type A personality, go kind of a thing. Everybody's different. And again, I think too, in contrast, I think that men wrestle with depression, and sometimes it manifests itself in drinking too much or anger, explosive anger or whatever. So yeah, I think it really, it's all, there's not one size fits all kind of thing with that whole thing.
Yeah. And we're talking to Julius Dudix, our morning show counselor, about depression. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And every week we've been tackling a different common mental health issue that people are dealing with in today's world. Depression is one of the most common, I would imagine. And when you look at the stats and you see more than 17 million American adults are dealing with this, close to 2 million children dealing with depression as young as age 3. You know that this is prevalent, and that's why we're discussing it today. Julius, what about people who fall in and out of depression? We hear a lot of times here in Connecticut, people are feel their depression come on, especially in the winter. But as it gets warmer and more bright out, the depression sort of goes away. So it's more environmentally triggering. What do you say for that? If you know that depression comes in seasons, what do you suggest?
Yeah, seasonal depression is something that a lot of people wrestle with. You've got to, first of all, acknowledge it. That, hey, you know, the fall's coming, or the spring is coming, or winter's coming. I'm going to have those feelings and so forth. And you almost have to be proactive in developing a plan of attack, so it just doesn't knock you off your feet like a wave. Part of that proactiveness is to kind of look at, you know, what are some of the sources? Why am I feeling what I'm feeling is the question that people have to ask themselves. Some of it is related to family history as well, Melissa. I mean, if your mother or grandmother, you know, or you've got relatives that wrestle with depression, it could be, you know, that could be one of the causes that you want to begin to get help for. But you want to really be specific in yourself and saying, you know, if this is going to come at a certain time, a certain place, I've got to almost take proactive steps to make sure that I can get some help at that point in time, so that I don't get knocked down by that wave. But.
And do you have to use medication to overcome depression?
Wow, that's a tough one, because there are a lot of people that are totally opposed, and I don't want to put medication in my body. But the truth is, there are these synaptic fluids that flow between our neurotransmitters and receptors, and sometimes they're off balance, and a little bit of Prozac or Fluoxetine or a little bit of Zoloft might help. And I always ask the question to a client, what have you got to lose by trying it? Because, you know, with the advent of the internet, what I'm seeing is a lot of times when I mention medication, then you really ought to go see a prescriber or somebody who can prescribe medication. The initial reaction is no, because what happens is people look at all the side effects of certain medications and they get paralyzed. And sometimes medication could be a good way to do it. But I'm a firm believer in kind of a balanced approach, medication, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, talk therapy, which is, I think, wonderful and has helped so many. You know, spirituality, getting in touch with who you are and you know, the God that loves you so much. Those are all ways to begin to treat it. But the basic thing is to get your eyes off of yourself and onto other people, because I think happy people are people who pretty much serve other people and who put each other's needs above your own needs. And that's something that's hard when you're caught in that season of depression, to get my eyes off of myself and onto my cousin or onto my son or my daughter or my spouse.
Mm-hmm.
That's very tough, because these feelings are so real, Melissa.
Yeah.
You know, you get up in the morning and I just don't feel like getting out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reality for so many. And that's where you've got to push yourself and say, what's the source of it? And how can I begin to really develop a plan to acknowledge, stay connected, you know, face the fears, that kind of thing. And it's really an attitude choice that you have to take at that point in time. But that is so hard when you're in that debilitative state.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to do that.
And Julius, I know one of the things that we always say is not to stay stuck. And one of the ways you could do that is by talking to someone. And whether it is you or somebody else, if you're a good starting point for people to just, you know, pick your brain, see what sure. can be done. What is your website for people who want to reach out?
Yeah, it's njcc.online. Or you can call the office at 203-243-7714 and make an appointment. But Melissa, loneliness, isolation is not a good place to be, especially when you couple that with depressive thought.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing somebody who's depressed can do is to isolate and just, yeah. I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to be with people. Because loneliness, I read an article recently about loneliness. It's as bad as smoking cigarettes in terms of, you know, the health.
Yeah, I think I was reading that actually in the statistics I was reading before. Let me just see really quickly.
Yeah,
it said adults with depressive disorder or symptoms have a 64% greater risk of developing things like coronary artery disease, among many other things, so like heart disease.
Yeah.
There's health data that supports exactly what you just said. You know, that's
yeah.
another layer of why it's so important that you address this and you don't let it slide. So I appreciate you doing that here on the show today, Julius. And I thank you always for tackling these subjects that I know are not easy, but it's really prevalent in today's world.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you for all you do, Melissa. You keep at it, and we'll talk to you next week.
Looking forward to it. Julius Dudek's here on WICC. Pretty big story in the health sector last week when we learned there was a new proposal for breast cancer screening to drop from age 50 to age 40. And so back with us on the show this morning is Dr. Valerie Brudis, who is a breast surgical oncologist with Hartford HealthCare's Cancer Institute St. Vincent's Medical Center, joining us now. Dr. Brudis, welcome back. So glad to have you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, of course. Tell us, Dr. Brudis, I know you're not like on the board or whatever you'd call it for making this kind of recommendation, but why do you think this recommendation was made?
Well, the incidence of breast cancer among women between the age of 40 to 49 in the United States have been gradually increased, and specifically when you look at the data from 2015 to 2019. And also, there are several other medical institutions, such as the American College of Radiology, the American Society of Breast Surgeons, who has been always advocating to start mammography at the age of 40.
So tell us, why do we think that we've seen such an uptick in breast cancer cases for people 40 to 49?
So we don't know exactly, you know, why we're seeing such an increase, but we certainly know that there are certain ethnic group that seems to have an increased risk of breast cancer at a younger age. specifically, you know, Black women and women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent.
Okay, so, but it sounds like, Dr. Brutus, we don't really know, essentially. Like, I mean, we don't have a concrete answer of if it's the food we're eating, the environment we're in, the stress we're under. None of that correlates at this point.
You're absolutely correct. At this point, we don't know exactly why we're seeing those increased numbers, but this is what the data is showing us. So that's okay. Why, you know, some of the recommendations, specifically for the American Society of Breast Surgeons, recommend that all women actually at the age of 25 should have what they call a personalized breast risk assessment, just to determine one's own risk and see what screening guideline that they should follow and when they should start their breast cancer screening.
Dr. Brutus, when was the recommendation put into place for age 50?
That was back in 2014.
Okay, so not even 10 years ago.
Not even 10 years ago.
That's pretty alarming in itself, no?
It is. And I think, you know, there's always been a discrepancy with the recommendation from the CDC and those of other, you know, medical boards. And that has created some confusion. So I hope that now that the recommendation aligns just to help patients make better decisions about their breast cancer screening recommendation.
And really quick, with a recommendation, does that mean you don't need a doctor's order to get screened? Is that what that essentially means? Because you'll have people who maybe they don't have a family history, but they're just nervous. You know, they read about the headlines, they you know, see the data, and they're like, I want to get screened, you know, at age 35. Is the recommendation something that you just would go at 40 without any questions asked? Or what does that mean, recommendations?
The recommendation just specifically specify that starting at the age of 40, women should consider to get, you know, a mammogram. In terms of do they need an order, I think it's going to vary, you know, by institution and by state. But okay. Most women, you know, or a person, if they want to screen an imaging, they can always call their provider, their OBGYN, their primary care provider, or even contact, you know, a breast center imaging that can offer them who they can see to have, you know, this prescription written. At St. Vincent's Healthcare, we offer, you know, personalized breast cancer screening, so the patient can certainly come get their imaging with us.
Now, Dr. Brutus, I know you specifically are a breast surgical oncologist, but I can't help but notice only a few years ago that the recommendation lowered in age for colonoscopies. And I remember that was because we saw a huge uptick. Weren't we seeing more of an uptick in colon cancer?
Yes, we are, and you're absolutely correct. Those recommendations also were adjusted. So before they recommended to start the screening colonoscopy at the age of 50, you know, now they drop it to 45. And this only applies to, you know, average risk population. So patients who have higher risk should even start to screen earlier.
Wow. Okay. So, Dr. Brutus, I know, again, this was a proposal. What are the chances that the recommendation goes through?
I hope they go through. I think, you know, I hope that all medical society that's been advocating that breast cancer continue to start at the age of 40 are going to take this opportunity to implement this recommendation, because we certainly know that this will help, you know, decrease breast cancer mortality if cancers are detected at an earlier stage.
And if it doesn't go through, Dr. Brutus, would you recommend to your patients to still get screened at a younger age? Like, would you recommend to our listeners, hey, if you're turning 40, even though, you know, maybe if it doesn't become official, you should think about getting screened earlier?
Absolutely. And I would also recommend to our listeners that they should have, you know, their own breast cancer risk assessment to see if they even qualify to be screened earlier. Because, you know, if someone has a risk secondary to a high family history or even the possibility of having a defective gene that increased their risk for cancer, if you know earlier, then those recommendations would be adjusted based on your own risk.
And Dr. Brutus, I know growing up as a female would, when you start to go to your doctor in your teenage years and even your college years, they teach you how to do breast examinations, you know, self-examining. Are there things that we should be looking for, you know, especially if, again, if the recommendation doesn't come through, we're still waiting till 50, or maybe people don't hear about, you know, that they've lowered the age to 40. What should we be looking for? Are there signs or things we should be looking for if breast cancer or even like a, you know, that there could be some concern with breasts? Like, is there anything we should be looking for?
Yes, there's definitely a thing that we should be looking for. For example, you know, if someone looks at their breast and they feel that one is bigger or there is some any changes of the skin, such as some dimpling in the skin, you know, or they notice a rash under a nipple or they feel a lump that is different. So these are warning signs. You know, if one notices that there is blood coming from their nipple, there's some warning signs that, you know, this might be associated with cancer. And also underneath the armpit as well, where the lymph nodes that drain the breast, you know, can contain cancer. So these are some of the signs that women can notice when they're doing their own evaluation.
Interesting. And again, if people want to learn more, you can always go online to hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. And Dr. Valerie Brutus, I thank you so much for coming on the show today. Breast surgical oncologist with Hartford HealthCare's Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Really appreciate you and giving us your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Again, Dr. Brutus here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
With so many layoffs happening, it's important that we talk about what to do and not to do if you find yourself in the position of being laid off. So our career strategist is here, Julie Bauke, to give us some tips and some strategies to not only handle ourselves properly in that unfortunate situation, but also to make sure that the job seeking portion of our journey isn't harder than it needs to be. So Julie, welcome back. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. So yeah, there's this article in the New York Times on Sunday, which really got me thinking. This guy named Roger Lee, he's got a site called layoffs.fyi. And all he does is catalog the layoffs just in the tech sector, though. But from all the stories we're seeing, you know, layoffs, it's interesting. It's a very interesting time. Layoffs are literally everywhere, yet the jobless numbers haven't really moved much.
Hmm.
So, you know, so what this means is that these people are, a lot of the folks that are getting laid off are not applying for unemployment, or they're getting snapped up fairly quickly by other companies. And so therefore they never make it into that number. And so normally when you see layoffs of the magnitude that we've seen pretty much across the board at this point, you also see a corresponding rise in the unemployment number. But it's confounding experts because it's like, well, wait a minute, this isn't happening. The unemployment number has barely budged. So it just begs the question, why not? And I think we live in such a complex workplace right now that people, they apply for unemployment and, you know, but they're also in a lot of ways able to make more money than they would in unemployment relatively quickly. And so they never really apply because you have to, if you can find a job, even if you're making more than you would get in unemployment,
mm-hmm.
then you're the expectation is you're not going to apply for unemployment. So it's just interesting the way all of this shifts. But what I really want to talk about is let's take it down to the personal level.
Yeah.
It's happened to you. It's happened to someone you love, someone in your household, someone you care about. And what do we do? Unfortunately, our first instinct is a bad one. Our first
yeah.
instinct, you know,
isn't that just human nature? Like
yeah.
revenge and get back at them, or you know, or to just
yeah.
like think that it's you're just kind of in your own bubble and no one sees it. But what's amazing is everyone sees it, even when you didn't realize it. Yeah, that's human nature, Julie Bauke, right?
I mean, it is. In all areas of life. Yeah, I think sometimes we get into action without really thinking through what we're getting into action toward.
Yeah.
And so my first piece of advice is stop. It's sort of like I think about stop, drop, and roll. You know, when there's fire advice we give the kids. But stop, step back, and think about what you want next. And I'm not saying you have to go on a retreat for 60 days. I'm saying at least step back and say, okay, I need to find a silver lining here. And based on all the conversations I've had with people who've just lost their jobs over the last couple of decades, you know, I feel very confident saying most people can see the silver lining, can tell you what they didn't like about their last job, And many people do feel some sense of relief that's not attached to the fact they've lost a salary, but more for a lot of people, it's like, you know what? I wasn't very happy. Mm-hmm. That unhappy at work number has not changed in decades. And so if you believe that 60 to 70% of people are disengaged and unhappy at work, then you've got to know that at least that percentage of the people who are being laid off are able to feel some sort of relief that now they get a chance to go find something better. And so you really want to lean into that and say, step back and say, okay, I now have an opportunity to improve my situation. Am I scared? Yes. Am I worried that I'll never be able to find a job again? Yes. You know, our brain goes all those bad places.
Right.
But you've got to center yourself and say, okay, this is an opportunity and I'm going to make the most of it. And once you commit to that mind frame or that frame of mind, I think you greatly increase your possibilities of finding something better.
So, Julie, can I ask you something? Because I don't think we've ever talked about this on the show.
Always ask me something, dear.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you. So in your professional, because you work with so many different people all in the workforce, and I was curious, in your professional opinion, why are people so miserable at work? Why is that the norm? Is it because of the people they work with? Is it because they ended up in a line of work they don't like? Like, what is the most popular? Is that the right word? What's the most common reason that people are so miserable at work?
So, great question. So, I created, based on my work, I created something I call the career happiness formula. And there are four pieces to it. And all four of these pieces must exist before you can really say you're wildly happy at work. And the first one is you have to like what you do, the content of your job, the tasks on your to-do list, the things people expect of you. You need to like it. If you're fortunate, you love it. In other words, what's required of you, you need to like it. The other thing is you need to be good at it. So we can like something and not be good at it, or we can be good at something and not like it. And in that second case, it's usually a cause of burnout. So I like it and I'm good at it. Those are the two, that's half of it. The next is it's something I can get paid to do. So in other words, the demand for what you do needs to be there. You can like to repair typewriters and be good at it, but if there isn't a call for it, you can't make a living from it. If you like it and you're good at it, but you can't get paid for it, it's a hobby. So not only does there need to be demand for what you do, but you also needs to pay what you need to make to live your life. And so the old market demand or what you can get paid to do is number three. And number four is really around culture, or as I call it, you need to work in a place in a way in which you can be successful. You can like your work, you can be good at it, you can be paid well, but you could have a miserable boss, horrible coworkers, a terrible commute, a culture in which is not aligned with your values, and you will be miserable. And so you think about it as a four-legged stool. And the problem is we have to be vigilant on all four of those legs at all times. One of those things can change and the whole stool will come toppling over. And for each of us, the career happiness formula looks different. And the first thing you got to do when you're unhappy at work is figure out which one of those things is causing the problem. So if you get laid off, say, did I like what I did? Was I good at it? Hopefully great at it. Was I paid what the market is paying, or was I underpaid? And fourth, was I a fit there? You know, was the culture a fit for me? And then figure out which one of those things was the weakest leg, or more than one in most cases, and commit to changing that. Now, of those four, when I do a poll, like if I do a webinar or I'm speaking to a group and I have people kind of say, think of your worst job, which one of those pieces of the career happiness formula was missing? 2/3 or more of the time, it was the fourth one. I liked what I did. I was good at it. I was paid well, but I was not a fit from a cultural standpoint. And that can literally be anything from poor leadership to my values weren't aligned with the organization. It was just a place to work that was not a fit for me. And that is in 2/3 or more of the cases.
Wow.
And so losing your job is a great opportunity to fix or tighten up any of the legs of your particular stool.
So Julie Bauke, our career strategist, is here, and we're talking about the things you should do and not do after you've been laid off, which, of course, we're not putting that on you. I hope that hasn't happened to you, and I hope it doesn't happen to you. But unfortunately, we're seeing it happening more and more. Here's a question for you, Julie, really quick, before we talk about the do's and don'ts. What do you think about AI and the fact that AI is probably going to take millions of people's jobs? And you know, we were talking about how, you know, people have all these skills and everything, but if you can file for unemployment and make more money that way, you're not going back to the workplace. Do you think as we see more AI, I should say artificial intelligence, take over common jobs, do you think we'll start to see people come out of the woodwork and all of a sudden unemployment numbers are going to tick up because, man, I need a job. I need to be able to, yeah, to work.
Yeah, I do. You know, there's a lot of trepidation out there in the markets in terms of, do we have a big layoff coming? When's it coming? Who's it going to impact? And there's been that talk has been around for the last couple of years. But the skills gap that we already have, because, you know, there are still all these jobs that remain unfilled because the available workers don't have the skills to fill them, which is right. One of the reasons why companies will look at AI. So, yeah, so that skills gap will widen because the companies are already looking for people with, you know, some either basic knowledge or facility with the particular AI tools that are relevant in their industry or profession, or at the very least, someone who is willing to go learn them. And so when you get laid off, you want to look at that and say, okay, what's my gap? So figure out, what do you want to fix? So next time I want to do more of this, or I want to work in this kind of a place. So you figure out which leg of the career happiness tool do you want to fix? The next step is to think about, is to go start getting out there and poking around on LinkedIn, on various job boards, but LinkedIn's power is just continuing to increase. Start reading the job descriptions and requirements for the types of jobs that appeal to you on some level. So in other words, you have to become a student of what the job market is looking for someone in your profession and industry, and then figure out, what are my gaps? What are the things that I could do to increase my marketability? And then go online, start watching videos, take courses, do things that help improve your marketability. The worst thing you can do is be employed for 6 months, and when someone says, tell me how you've been spending your time, there's no talk about how you've looked to sharpen your axe, pretty much. All you've done is projects around the house and look for a job. You need to add, it makes you more attractive as a candidate to say, here's what I've done to increase my marketability. It shows a real commitment to self-development. So get clear on what you want to fix, what you want to do more of, less of, never again. Then look at, what does the market want? Because you can want something, but if the market doesn't want you back, again, that's a hobby. And then figure out, what can I do to upskill? And then you don't want to start. This is the biggest mistake people make, in my opinion, is starting to reach out to their network too early. So if you don't have a clear and coherent statement of what you want to do next and why you're qualified to do that and what's in it for the company hiring you, you are simply, as I've named my book, peeing on your shoes, which is why I wrote the book, Stop Peeing on Your Shoes, because it, you know, it's about the 7 mistakes that people make when they're starting a job search. And if you just simply don't make those mistakes, then your job search will go much more smoothly because you don't have to go back and start over because you have been out there peeing on your shoes. And so clarity about what you want, take a deep breath and figure out, what do I want? How can I upskill to make myself more marketable? And then when I'm ready to start reaching out to people, am I ready to answer the 3 core questions? Why did you get laid off? What are you looking to do next? And, you know, tell me about yourself. Those are the 3 core questions that before you begin any job search, you should have them nailed, because anything less than that,
you're not desirable.
Unprepared. You're not desirable because how you go about your search is a reflection into what kind of employee you're going to be.
Yeah. That's so true. And I know Julie's talked about this on the show before, being so careful about what you post online, how you conduct yourself, even before, God forbid, you're cut from a job. It's just so important that you're not just this facade at work, but also in your personal life, how you conduct yourself outside of work, personally, online, you know, whatever the case may be. So, Julie, always appreciate getting these tips and tricks and just really getting a better understanding of how the workforce is changing and how we should handle ourselves, good, bad, or indifferent. So I thank you for that.
You are so welcome. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it. Julie Bauke, our career strategist. She hosts Julie on the Job right here on WICC every single week. So be sure to catch her again next week with a new topic that we'll have on the show.